This is CliffCentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
Right, folks, good morning. Welcome to Auto Central, brought to you by Auto Trader, your trusted motoring marketplace. We have a empty studio and a lot of stuff to get through, so it's just Lawrence and I today. Hi, Lawrence.
How are you, buddy?
Yeah, lekker, man. Wait, I can't hear you there. Your sound's up. What are you on? You on?
Can't hear myself either.
Can't hear yourself either? Try now?
Yeah, I'm still there.
Oh, there we go, because you're on mic 2, not on mic 3. There we go. How's it going?
I've got no complaints.
Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Bright between the rain.
Right between the rain. There was quite a bit of rain this weekend.
Yeah.
Which made for it's an exciting sport. But anyway, let's get straight into it. We've got quite a bit to get through. I don't know if you've seen, but clearly not in South Africa at the moment, but on the opposite side of the planet. The polar vortex. Jeez, like. I actually had a mate who was in Toronto, and he said it's absolutely freezing. But I just thought this story was really, really amazing. But Chicago is so ridiculously cold that its railroad tracks need to be on fire to keep the trains moving.
So, well, if I read the story, and basically it's not really to keep the trains moving. Basically what happens is the metal contracts
so much
that it actually pulls the bolts out of the railway ties.
Yeah, those big metal rivets.
So before they can fix it, they have to heat the steel up so they can pull it straight and then put the bolts back in again.
Which is quite a problem to have, I think. I mean, where they've got 140,000 miles of privately owned standard gauge rail in the United States. So I think keeping that in check, because their railroad infrastructure is pretty decent.
Yeah, transcontinental. The Pacific Western, I think.
Yeah.
Western Pacific. Basically, there's like three different rail companies that own all of the railway track. And you can put something on a train in San Francisco, and in a week's time, you can pick it up in New York.
Yeah.
And it's traveled across the country on a single train.
So what you're saying is not like Metro Rail?
No.
Completely different. We just burn our tracks for shits and giggles, you know, not because it's cold. But so I see. And then also when they do the lane changeovers,
yeah, the switch tracks.
Yeah, they have to. They take big pieces of rope and they soak them in kerosene and then
paraffin.
Yeah, and then they burn them to keep the tracks warm.
So look, it's interesting. But yeah, it is incredibly cold in other parts of the world. I had a meeting on Friday morning with somebody in the UK, and they were actually 15 minutes late because it snowed in their town for the first time in like 7 years.
So also running around doing snow angels and whatnot.
Yeah, building snowmen and stuff. And then I have a friend in Vancouver. His toilet tank exploded.
How?
The water in the tank at the top froze, and it cracked
at the top.
Yeah, and it cracked the pores. It got so cold in the house that it...
Jeez, like
your toilet exploded. So
that's crazy. Yeah, well, I see that the high temperature was in Chicago was expected to be minus 13 degrees,
and we get antsy when it gets like 5.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then like minus 30 with the wind chill factor and all that stuff. So anyway, bloody cold on the other side of the planet. I'm glad I don't live there. But if you're living in the Western Cape, I see that there are the calls for comment on the proposed vehicle license fee hike. So what they want to do essentially is they want to increase the rate of the license fees by, I think it's 3%. And the reason for this is obviously to ensure that the roads are kept in a decent condition.
This is an interesting thing because as far as I remember, and I speak under correction, your license fees in Gauteng are almost double what your license fees are in the Western Cape. So in the Western Cape, you license a car, it costs you $160 for the year.
Yeah.
In Gauteng, that same vehicle will cost you $360.
But is that just because we've got a bigger infrastructure here? More
it's
roads.
Local government.
Local government.
That's by region.
Yeah.
The license fees differ in Limpopo. They differ in the northwest, and they differ in the Eastern Cape.
I think that's
so what
it's
you
crazy.
End up with is you have long-distance trucking companies.
Yes.
Well, their headquarters will be in Gauteng.
Yeah, because the license fees are cheaper, but they'll keep their bases.
But all the trucks are licensed in the Western Cape. So I don't really have an issue with it. I mean, I've just recently been to Cape Town, and I've seen what the roads there look like. They do not have as many roads as we do.
Yeah.
And the roads that they do have are in some places in a shocking condition.
Yeah. It says here a total of 7,019 kilometers of provincial roads are in fair to very good condition. It said that the money would help reduce the road maintenance backlog, which has been decreased by about 60% over the last 7 years. During the 2017-18 financial year, 63,080 square meters of surface roads were upgraded in the province, while 915,000 square meters were rehabilitated, 45,900 kilometers of gravel roads were bladed, and 22 Ks were upgraded to surfaced roads. I personally don't think there's a problem. If their money is going to keeping the roads in a good condition,
absolutely,
then by all means.
You know, as far as I can remember, there's only one toll road in the Western Cape.
Yeah.
It's the Huguenot Tunnel.
Yeah.
They don't have to pay tolls at the rate
like
that
we do on a Monday to Friday when you're just driving on the normal highways.
Yeah, if I come to the office on any day of the week, yeah, it costs me 25 rand.
Because how many are you going, what, by about three or four gates?
No, just the one, but it's...
Only one?
10 rand 50.
Oh, okay.
So it's 10 rand 50 to get to the office and 10 rand 50 to get back. And that's just if I want to avoid the traffic.
Yeah.
So... I don't think that the people in Cape Town can really complain too much.
Yeah,
they should just suck it up and say, you know what, if the license fees are going to go up by $50, live with it.
Yeah, exactly. The world's longest electric car journey hits 89,000 kilometer mark. I thought the story was really, really interesting. So driving between towns is something that many electric car drivers fear. But there's a guy from Holland, and I'm not being... ugly when I say a Dutchman. Wacker, yeah, hasn't just conquered the so-called range anxiety. He's actually tackled the 89,000 kilometer road adventure that's taken him through 33 countries in 1,050 days. So far, Wacker has taken his Blue Bandit, which is a Volkswagen Golf 5 Estate, retrofitted with an electric motor, through Europe, the Middle East, India, South East Asia, and a large chunk of Australia, where he recently pulled into Adelaide after an outback adventure. The crazy thing is he's done this entire trip without any money. So he's literally driven through all these different countries, and he obviously phones ahead. He finds out where he can get a meal, where he can get a bed to sleep in, and if he can please plug his car into your garage so he can charge it overnight. And the distance that he's doing on a single charge is about 200 kilometers. And so far he's been helped up by 1,700 people whose offers have obviously determined his route. So he's just literally phoning ahead saying, will you help me out? People are saying yes, and he's like, okay, cool, well, there's the next stop on my journey. And wow, what a cool thing to do.
It's pretty cool, but I noticed that there's something missing from his little route here, and that is the African continent.
Yes, well, look.
He needs to come play here, and then we'll see how far he gets.
Yeah, then he'll probably need something that's got a little bit of a longer range, you know, because, unfortunately.
Well, look, it's an awesome idea, and proving that electric cars are as good as petrol ones.
Absolutely.
Well, enough forethought and, planning.
Yeah, well, this is why he's done it. He says electric vehicles are significant part of the solution to the global environmental problem we all share. Sadly, the uptake of electric cars is going slow, mainly because there's a lot of prejudice and people believe that they're not reliable or not fit to cover long distances. So from driving from Holland to literally to the other side of the world, he hopes to change people's minds. And I think the more people that kind of hear the story and go, you know, it actually is possible, I think it's going to, I think he's doing a bloody good job.
Oh, really, kudos, really cool. Kudos to him.
Yeah, kudos to him.
That's not something I would want to do.
I think it's something I would like to do.
Get stuck in the Australian outback with no juice.
As long as you've got a boomerang, Tony, you can catch anything.
And a solar panel.
There we go. Not such bad news, but never good news. There's going to be a slight petrol price increase predicted for February.
It's only a few cents.
Yeah, following the fuel price rollercoaster in 2018, which we all experienced, in which prices finally subsided meaningfully towards the end of the year, South African motorists can look forward to some price stability, at least for the next month. So they say it's going to go up kind of 8 cents a litre to 13 rand 50.
As long as it's cents and not rands, I'm not really concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And unleaded's going up quite a bit as well, with 93 unleaded rising to 13.87 in the latter regions.
Yeah, as long as it stays under 15.
Yeah, because it nearly got to that, didn't it?
Yeah, we were at 16, 14, I think, at one stage last year.
Well, the rand's actually doing pretty well against the dollar at the moment, so let's just hope it continues.
Yeah.
Heaven knows why. This was really nice. I see vehicle price hikes continue to trail general inflation. So South Africa's new and used vehicle price index continues to trail general inflation, according to the vehicle pricing index released by TransUnion. The index reveals that new vehicle prices showed an annual increase of 2.5% during the fourth quarter of 2018 versus 2.4% in quarter four of 2017, while used vehicle inflation slowed to 1.6% in the last quarter of 2018 from 3.5% a year earlier. Both were well below the general consumer price inflation of 4.5%. And I think what this means is that you can see, I know TransUnion in the article, it says, yeah, this is pushing buyers into more affordable cars, with the percentage of new and used vehicles being financed below 200,000 now standing at 37%, and that's up a percentage from 36% in the previous quarter. So, I mean, and I think you see it on the roads. You're not seeing as many fancy, flashy cars, and I think people are actually wising to the fact that a car is merely a mode of transport. You don't need to...
What we are actually seeing from the Ask Auto Trader side.
Yes.
We have a very, very large influx of questions around the maintenance on smaller vehicles.
Yeah.
We get questions about the boot space on smaller vehicles, tire sizes on smaller vehicles, fuel economy on smaller vehicles. Nobody's really asking questions about XC90s and Cayennes and things like that. Although those vehicles do sell, and the people that are buying them don't really have to worry too much
about
where their next loaf of bread is coming
from. Yeah.
So, yeah, I would definitely say that people are trading down.
Yeah.
They're selling off bigger cars with bigger engines to buy smaller cars. And
keeping that one big car for the weekend and stuff like that, and then having a run around for your Monday to Friday kind of, you know.
Or they're selling cars. They're selling their cars completely and relying on Lyft and Uber.
Yeah.
And bicycles or walking. It's cheaper than $13.50 a
litre. No, it is. Unless you are fancy shoes to walk in. Like, see, have you seen the shoes that I wear? Very, very fancy. Almost the same price as cars, I reckon. This story is really, really nice. So why is it so important to donate your old child car seat? So according to research carried out by the American Automobile Association, safety belts and child car seats are the most effective devices in preventing serious injuries and deaths in vehicle crashes. I think we all know that. The research goes on to state that seat belts and car seats obviously contact the strongest parts of the body, spread crash forces over a wide area, and help the body slow down to protect the brain and spinal cord. And this information was shared by Peggy Mars, founder and managing director of Wheelwell, a non-profit organization that advocates for children's road safety in South Africa, at the recent Women in Transport conference. This thought-provoking information on child safety and the importance of properly restraining a child in an appropriate seat while traveling in a vehicle resonated strongly with co-panelist Petunia Sibanyoni, CEO of Inspector Car. And what Petunia and her team have done is they are now calling on anybody, and you probably fit into this category. You probably have an old car seat lying around in the garage somewhere, or a booster seat. I mean, your girls are...
I donated those seats 2 years ago.
Okay.
The first one we moved on to a family member.
Yeah.
The second one we actually donated to Wheelwell.
Okay, nice.
That was about 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, so there's been studies, and I just want to read you through some of the stats here. It says safety belt harnesses and car seats reduce the risk of death to infants, so aged between under 1 year, by 71%, and toddlers between the ages of 1 and 4 years by 54%. Booster seats use reduces the risk of serious injury by 45% for children aged 4 to 8. In light of this information, Inspector Cars announced that it will be collecting, refurbishing, and donating car seats to all those less fortunate as part of a CSR initiative. They're appealing to parents who own car child car seats that they no longer use to consider donating it to a deserving family. Their dealerships across the country are the drop-off points, and if you drop your old car seat off at an Inspector Car, they'll take it, they'll get it refurbed, and then they'll donate it to a family that obviously can't afford one, which is really, really solid.
I don't know if you've checked any time recently what one of those chairs costs.
No, it's ridiculous.
Anywhere between 850 and 2,500 rand.
Yeah.
Depending on what kind of brand you want and if it has ISOFIX,
yes,
etc.
Yes.
I think it's a brilliant initiative, and once again, if you do have one of these and you do not have a family member that needs one,
yeah, then just donate it.
Give it to Inspector Car.
Yeah.
Don't let it sit in the shed and gather spider webs.
Yeah.
There is somebody out there who needs it, and
will use it.
Will probably save their kid's life one day.
Absolutely. So good on Expectocar for doing that. And then I thought this was really, really cool. I mean, I think no one, that's probably a very, very low percentage of people, have never not driven and somehow got a fine of some sort, whether it's a parking fine or a speeding fine. But very few of us make it through life without a speeding ticket. And I know I've been caught. I'm sure you've been caught. I'm sure there are a whole bunch of people that are listening right now that have been caught. But it's what we got here is a list of some of the world's most expensive speeding fines. And I thought we'd spend a bit of time just going through this. And I actually found some really, really interesting stuff here. So did you know that if you get caught speeding in Finland, their fines are – income based. So basically they'll have a look at your profile, your tax profile, and according to what your income is, that's how they'll work the fine out. Because
so if you're poor, speed.
Well, pretty much exactly. Yeah. So if you're living below the breadline, you know, your fine's going to be a lot less than
if you're living below the breadline. You won't have a car.
Yeah. So their fines are income based, and as you'll see, this means that you know if you can afford a Ferrari, then you're going to get an eye-watering ticket. Here in the United States, Virginian residents have faced insane fines of over $3,000 since the legislation in the mid 2000s. But I just want to run through some of these fines. So in 2006, the BBC reported on businessman Ronald Kloss hitting 156 miles per hour in his BMW while talking on his cell phone. He got a $4,000 fine for doing that. And in the same year, a British Porsche 911 driver got hit with an $8,000 fine for touching 172 miles an hour on a back road. And he was driving dangerously as well. So, I mean, those are big numbers. Hey, $8,000.
Yeah.
Well, what's that? Nearly, that's over 100K.
No, we've had a couple here in this country where they've been approaching 100K bracket. Guys that are doing 300 plus on the N1.
Yeah.
Throw the book at them.
Yeah, Canada tends to have fairly high fines for speeding, and $1,000 isn't a rarity. In 2010, a Canadian motorcycle enthusiast caught himself a bank balance denting $12,000 fine as part of a negotiation for him to keep his license. If you're a Canadian or plan on visiting Canada, it's worth remembering that in Ontario, fines can reach $10,000 and up to $25,000 as well. Dubai tourist, $47,000. A British tourist visiting Dubai managed to rack up a $47,000 in tickets after renting a Lamborghini. So he obviously was out on the road and didn't realize that they have radars on the road, and every single radar.
Have you been on the Sheikh Zayed Road?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I have. It's 8 lanes, maybe in places wider.
Oh, really?
It is dead straight, and when you see the cars in Dubai, you sort of wonder. Okay. Also, that road is incredibly busy, and everybody drives well over the 120 kilometer mark.
Is it 120K? Speed limit somewhere places, around there. Hello, George.
How's it done?
How are you doing?
Can you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Most places are 120 Ks in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if you're driving that fast on that road, you deserve whatever they give you.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. So it says here, in a standing fine that was then topped off, you got it off by a $28,000 cost of recovering the car after it was impounded. So that I probably shot himself in the foot there. Finnish businessman, $60,000. Sliding scale of speeding fines is linked to the income of the perpetrator. The idea is that the rich don't just get to break the laws because it costs them considerable amount of money less to walk away. In the case, this businessman managed to catch a mind-bending $60,000 speeding ticket for going just 14 miles an hour over the speed limit.
I was just going to say, did they catch him in that Toyota Corolla hatchback?
I don't know what they caught him in, but his income was $7 million a year.
Throw the book at him.
Absolutely. Oak must pay. $71,000, another Finnish Swedish tycoon. This Oak was only, if I remember reading correctly, he's 27 years old.
Ridiculous. Throw the book at him.
Ridiculous. And then an Australian millionaire. Australian laws are harsh when it comes to what they call hooning. In this case, an Australian millionaire had his $2,000 Gallardo confiscated despite the fact that he wasn't even driving it. His mechanic had taken it for a joyride and managed to get himself clocked up by the Aussie boys in blue in a 43-mile-per-hour zone doing 99 miles an hour. So they just, yeah. So, but you see, there again, that is where policing comes into effect because the guys actually are policing properly. So if you break the rules of the road, like you said,
get caught.
Yeah, throw the book at you. Absolutely throw the book at you.
Yeah, that's why I can't, you know, I mean, I love Ferraris, I love exotic cars, but in today's world, where can you even get that car out of first gear?
Yeah, exactly. But I suppose that's when, you know, you've got to have these track
days. It's an Autobahn.
Yeah, but then you've got to get to Germany with your car, right?
Well, if you can afford that car, getting to Germany with your car is not
a problem. Yeah, but you're not going to go there every single weekend. So, you know, it's all fair and well driving it. But, you know, if you're sitting in traffic in a Lamborghini and you're sitting in traffic in a Toyota Taz, does it really make a difference?
Hardly any difference.
You're still sitting in traffic.
You're not sitting in traffic. You are traffic.
Yeah, you are causing part of the problem. Yeah, so that's kind of what's gone down in the news over the last week. Gents, Formula One fast approaching, and I see that drivers to attend the official 2019 Formula One launch. So every Formula One driver will attend the official launch event for the 2019 season just prior to the first race in Melbourne. When is that? That's coming up now, isn't it? March.
Yeah, the first races are in March, and then the season starts.
Yeah, so I see there were a whole bunch of obviously the team bosses and stuff like that saying that they don't want to go, you know, to the launch because that's when they put the cars out and show, don't they?
Yeah, I mean they launch them sporadically and over time, but they're all out there at one particular event.
Yeah, so it says here that the teams rejected the proposal because they didn't want to share attention with the competition. But I see now all these guys have, F1 has announced that this free event to take place at the city of Melbourne will involve all 20 drivers and their respective team principals. So, and I don't know, is there any other news that's come out of the F1 world?
No, I mean, people have been focused on Mick Schumacher.
Yeah,
and Kimi's testing with Alpha.
Yeah, so other than that, they try and keep it as hush-hush as they can until the last possible minute because they don't want the other teams to know what they're doing.
And I see there's been some changes. I know that there's now new regulations on the front of the vehicle. What's it called?
Oh, the wings.
The wings on the front. You're only allowed 5 fins on it. Or?
Yeah, so there's been a number of changes. One of them have been the wings on the front, so that so the airflow through the car and then the fin on the back has also changed, and it's all changed by the FIA so that cars can get closer to the back of the car in front of them. So what effectively has happened is they've changed the aerodynamics of the car so that the pocket behind the car.
Yes.
So usually the cars have these diffusers on the back.
Okay.
Underneath, and then the wing usually angles the air so that pocket becomes as short as possible.
So guys can't slipstream.
So you can't slipstream.
Correct.
And now what the FIA have done is they've changed the rules so that pocket is longer.
So you actually, if you get close enough.
If you get close enough, you can pass.
You'll be able to sit behind the guy and shoot yourself out.
The trick is to get close enough.
Correct.
And that's what's been the problem. Is
dirty air.
Yeah.
And they're sort of hoping that it's going to, in doing so, make the racing better.
More exciting.
More exciting, that it doesn't just become a procession from pole
to finish.
Yeah.
But I suppose it wasn't really like that last year. I mean, last year was actually
last year was actually a lot more exciting than the previous 5.
Yeah. I suppose to the back end of the season, I mean, from what I recall, Hamilton just really started to clean up. But
well, it was I think Ferrari lost that. Mercedes didn't win it.
Uh-huh.
You know,
I like the way you said that. They didn't lose. They just gave it away.
They gave it away. They definitely did. So so the front wing is slightly wider and higher and a lot more simplified, and it helps chasing the car in front of you. So it's about 200 millimeters wider, which is what 20 centimeters is,
which is quite big.
There's new barge boards, so the barge boards are smaller, repositioned, and also makes for a less disruptive aerodynamic or dirty air, as Lawrence put it. The rear wing is wider and higher to create that pocket behind the car. There's new brake ducts. New brake ducts. What this is designed to do is reduce the aerodynamic exploitation of the brake ducts. So as the air flows through these brakes, they use it for aerodynamic force and to create certain air flows around the car. And then one interesting thing is the biometric gloves. So the drivers are now going to have biometric gloves that can monitor their heart rates, their blood pressure, all of that stuff.
Oh, so we're going to get new telemetry on screen.
Yeah, so you'll be able to see what's
Lewis,
like. I mean, that's
Lewis,
kind of like
your heart rate is up. Please slow down. Take a deep breath.
I think it's in the event of a crash, they can actually they can actually tell whether that driver's okay, not okay, get there quicker, it's okay to.
Wasn't there a bit of a controversy last year about the wheels that Mercedes-Benz were using? That they were an aerodynamic device, the way the spokes on the wheels were designed.
Well, I can't remember that. It could very well be. There was a lot of controversy. So while they were winning, everybody was like, oh, they're doing something illegal. Yeah. It always happens. Always freaking happens.
No, I suppose you've got to get ahead of the game, right? And you've got to do that by reinventing yourself. Yeah. So these guys are continuously disrupting themselves week in and week out. I mean, I don't think we understand, we all switch on the telly on a Sunday and you watch this race and it's fantastic.
Because they've got some guy that's working on what is the best angle for the little side winglet for the rear angle of this thing and what material. They've got some guy that just works on that little
every component, part, I'm sure, has been, tested to its ultimate.
And then in the previous year's races, they've had a situation where they've only been allowed 105 kilograms of fuel, which means the drivers had to fuel manage at the same time, which means you can't use the full power of the car all the time. And now the FIA have said, okay, you can use 110 kilograms of fuel.
Ooh.
Which
when are they going to allow the guys to refuel? Actual refueling during the race, because it's like putting fuel and tires and then the pit.
Well, that used to be the case. I remember,
a little bit more exciting.
Then there were safety issues and a few people set alight. And
so there's a change now. So you can't do tyres and petrol at the same time.
For the last few years they haven't.
You can't do fuel, yeah.
You get do qualifying.
Yeah.
And then you start the race on what fuel was in the car.
And that's it?
That's it. So if you do your qualifying, you want the pole position, you put 20 litres of fuel in the car, you start the race with 10. So you do 5 laps and then you've got to go in and fill up.
How quickly do those cars get rid of that petrol, that fuel? I mean, can they burn it pretty quickly?
Yeah. Those cars, during the actual race, they are not running at full RPM. They are like...
They're trying to save fuel. So,
like the way I drive to Durban.
There's a trade-off between...
One tank and you freewheel downhill all the way.
There's a trade-off between... I mean, 5 kilos is a lot of weight for a Formula One car. There's a trade-off between how heavy the car is and how fast it is. So the more weight you put on in fuel,
the slower
you are. You can go longer. So they've got to find this optimal balance between, okay, we've got to do 55 laps and we've got to do it at this speed. So do we put in 101 kilograms of fuel or 102 kilograms of fuel?
So, yeah, it's that's why if you watch the race... The lap times in the beginning are usually between 2 and 7 seconds longer than what they would be for the qualifying. So then you end up with, as the race progresses, by the time you get to like lap 42, the lap times just start tumbling.
Because the car's lighter and lighter and lighter.
Because they're just burning the fuel off.
Sure, I didn't know. So that when they're doing their qualifying and that's the tank of fuel that you're on.
Yeah.
You're allowed to fill up now before the race.
So you're allowed to fuel the car before the race.
So then qualifying,
they put minimal fuel in there. Yeah. That's why those qualifying lap times are so high.
30 Rand, 95, please.
Yeah. 10 Rand, 95.
What's that, a litre?
Yeah, there you go.
So just like that.
They put fuel in the car for the qualifying to do 3 laps. That's it. You know, your out lap, your flying lap, and then your in lap. Yes. And that's it.
That's amazing.
And then if there's weather, now they've got to decide, this is where strategy, if it starts raining during the qualifying, okay, maybe we can do 2 flying laps. Yeah. Now we've got to put fuel in for 4 laps. Out lap, 2 qualifying, and an in lap.
37 Rand, 59. Oh my gosh.
So, no, the Formula One is not as boring as you think if you really get into the detail in this and the strategy.
That's why there's 7 guys sitting on the pit wall with headphones and computers and stuff, because they monitor everything.
Yeah. It's quite interesting when they tap into and they like, Lewis, and the guys are having a chat. I mean, I find that really exciting.
And that is essentially, like George said, Mercedes didn't win last season as much as Ferrari gave it to them with piss poor management.
There was team problem.
Yeah.
Definitely.
They had the car. They just screwed up every single race. With
but I suppose
strategy.
That's like any sport then, isn't it? You know,
well,
whether it's calling the guys
rugby
in
or
late. You know?
They put a new floor on the Ferrari after, I think it was a couple of races. They were creaming it. And they put a new floor on the Ferrari and suddenly the thing was slower. It took them probably half a dozen races to figure out, hold on, let's put the old floor back.
So there was a flaw in the floor.
There was a flaw in the floor. And then the car was faster again. I mean, typical.
Chops. Anyway, well, look, the more you actually want to watch. And it's quite exciting to understand that. So thank you for sharing your knowledge with me. I now know a little bit more, guys. So just in terms of topical content, and I know that this story came out when we were on air 2 weeks ago, and we all know that Prince Philip, who's 97 years old, he dominated the news when he overturned his car close to the Sandringham estate. And there was, like I said, early on in January. And I think what I wanted to just chat about, and it was a question that Gareth asked to me as well, and I think he had the same conversation with you, George, but I thought maybe we could just sit here and just chat about this a little bit. Do you think that there should be an age limit cutoff as to, you know, when are you too old to drive, and should there be a driving limit?
I don't know if a number is a good idea.
Yeah, I agree, because there's a difference between a healthy 90-year-old and an unhealthy 90-year-old.
Look, my mom is 66,
okay,
and she's still driving.
But that's not old,
okay? But my mother is active.
Mm.
She can...
She's healthy.
Yeah, and this is what I said to you off air.
Yes.
And putting a number is dangerous. It is now, you should be able to say, right, at 58,
yes,
that is when you should start going for your yearly evaluation. If the first thing you do when you open up your car door is not put your foot out, but put your Zimmer frame out,
yeah,
then you should not be behind the wheel of a car.
Sure.
I know we do eye tests and stuff, but eye tests is one thing. You can have excellent eyesight.
Yeah.
But your brain
reaction
is...
Times
your reaction
bad,
time. Yeah. So your hand-eye coordination.
That needs to be addressed.
So I mean, and you said this, you should be, when you reach a specific age, and I agree with this. I mean, I still think that, I mean, and you know, the way people are taught their driving license, that changed from when, you know, when we learned to drive.
Yeah.
And I think you should be tested, you know, maybe when you are age, every 5 years. And
the big thing that what I said there was, it's free.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you turn 58, you go for your yearly free evaluation to check that you can still catch a tennis ball, you know. Your legs can stretch out and your spine isn't skew and you aren't like half paralyzed.
And you can strong enough to open a door, that kind of stuff.
That should be, yes. And it'll stop 87-year-old grandma in her 1972 Cortina when she's staring through the steering wheel, barreling down the freeway with an eye patch on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I suppose, you know.
Look, I'll be honest with you. I have got family members that were very, very old.
Mm.
And actually, like, parents and aunties and uncles had to take their keys away.
Yes.
And it's a difficult thing because you don't want to take away somebody's independence.
No, because you are taking away their independence, essentially.
And they will fight you tooth and nail.
Absolutely.
But then, like I said, if they want to fight for it, go and do your yearly evaluation. And if you pass, by all means, go for a drive.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you see that being implemented? When you reach, I mean, what is, let's put a number there. Do you think it's when you reach 50, is it when you reach 55, is it when you reach 60? What do you think?
Depends. I mean, it depends on where society is in terms of medical health and the general life expectancy of human beings.
Mm.
So if the general life expectancy is, you know, is 70 or 80, and you know, today 60 was yesterday 70, then implement it from the age of 60.
Yeah.
And then reevaluate it every couple of years. Okay, life expectancy has gone up. People are generally healthier. Let's do, 65.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's an answer. It just, I think you're right. There is a certain age needs to be reached where you get evaluated on a regular basis.
But do you think that should be implemented from day dot when you get your driving license? So you get your driving license at 18, at 25, you do your first re-evaluation.
You could have a big gap initially. So, when you get your license at 18, every 10 years. And then when you reach let's say, I don't know, 50 every 5 years. Yeah. And then when you reach 60 every two years or whatever.
So it should be a sliding scale. So like, I mean, I agree with you there.
You know, so you also don't know. If you're 18 years old, 2 years later, you might be involved in an accident.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
You know, you might lose part of your mind.
Yeah.
Good idea to probably reevaluate people on a regular basis.
And to be honest, I've seen some older people drive much better than young people as well.
MS?
Multiple sclerosis. Yeah.
These are diseases that are coming out. They're affecting people at a young age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I have a friend of the family who was recently diagnosed with something very similar to MS. She still has her mobility, but we don't know for how long. And at what point do you say to her, sorry, sweetie, you can't drive anymore because you can't lift your arms up past a certain point. You can't operate the vehicle.
Yeah, because that's essentially what you're doing. I mean, it's an operator's license. We also have a driving license, but you're operating a piece of heavy machinery.
Yeah.
And then let's just take that a little step further. Do you think you should be limited to the type of car you should drive? I mean, should you be in a, you know, if you reach a certain age, you have to drive a car that's got a higher safety rating?
No, I mean, I think type certification is probably a good idea. You know, like with aircraft, but not as. I mean, one car is similar to another car,
sure.
But you know, if you go from driving a Hyundai i20 to
a Ford F350,
like freaking Lamborghini or something, yes, I think you should be reevaluated, or you should at least go for a driving lesson and prove that you've done it.
Capable of doing that.
You know, I watched this video over the weekend with this. A Mustang, 1968 Mustang. They ripped the V8 out of it, and they've put an electric motor in it. And I see
Martin's in India, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, they put electric drivetrain on it and batteries, etc. And this thing does 0 to 100 in 1.8 seconds.
Oh my gosh!
1.8 seconds, and the driver was saying that he doesn't let valets park that car because they just have to feather the throttle slightly, and the car's out of control.
Yeah, because it probably becomes. I mean, you know, we spoke at the office a while ago about safety and stuff like that. We were actually talking off air 2 weeks ago about, and I never realized how sensitive a gun trigger was. And I suppose to that point, this is the exact same thing.
Yeah.
You touch that throttle.
And you're going to be driving into something.
So you absolutely have to know how to drive it.
Yeah.
So you should maybe be evaluated on the type of car you're driving.
We have the same conversation with bikes. You go and get your motorcycle license.
And you can get onto anything.
And you did your license on a 250, and now you can legally climb on an 1100 and go and grease yourself.
Yeah.
There really should be some sort of evaluation. Yes, do your license on the tooth. Yes, you can ride a motorcycle.
Yes.
Can you ride a motorcycle?
Cycle. Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah. Mm. Absolutely. So, interesting. And we'll see what happens. I mean, I don't see anything like that happening in South Africa, you know, anytime soon. I think we've got bigger fish to fry and problems to worry about and get sorted out. But I think it is a good debate. And I think it makes for, you know, it's something to think about. The next story, and you spoke about this on Friday on Gareth's show, and I was absolutely shocked. I'm probably sitting here now with disease on my hand. But you said, don't touch your steering wheel. It may be dirtier than a toilet seat.
Mm.
And it says, have you ever got into a friend's car and it's like, it's just a little bit, it's not how, you know, you keep your car. You know, I've got two boys, so keeping my car clean is a real challenge sometimes because they, you know, there's always a pair of slops or cricket sparks or something in the back of the seat. But it just says that carrentals.com surveyed 1,000 drivers to see how often they cleaned out their car's interiors. An alarming 32% of respondents said they only clean their car out once a year. I mean, I find that disgusting. And an additional 12% said they never clean their car's interior. So why is it so important to clean out your car? Well, maybe it's a lot dirtier than you think. So I don't know if you want to go into the nuts and bolts here, George.
Yeah, so they measure the car, well, the bacteria that gets found in a unit called a colony forming unit. On average, and this is per square centimeter, and on average, a car steering was found to have 629 colony forming units per square centimeter. And this is 6 times dirtier than a cell phone screen, 4 times dirtier than a public toilet seat, and 2 times dirtier than a lift or elevator button. But believe it or not, a petrol pump, and obviously not in South Africa so much because there's not so many people touching it,
yeah,
is 11,800 times more dirty than a public toilet seat.
That is absolutely...
Okay, do yourself a favor, Tom.
Yes.
Get a baby wipe.
Yes.
And go and wipe down your steering wheel.
You see how black it is?
Yeah.
It is manky.
Yeah.
And it's just because it's a touch surface. And it's not only the steering wheel. It is the door cards where your door handle is. Yes. It is the handbrake, the gear lever, and anything around that. It really is. I think there's no other word to describe it other than manky. Mm.
But how often do you... I get to a point where I'm like, no, I actually can't anymore. And it's not even a filthy state. I mean, I've got into people's cars where it's like, how do you actually get into this? No. It's
once a month.
I always evaluate somebody's home.
Yes.
Based on the state of their car.
Yeah.
So if the car's untidy and dirty, you know the kind of house they live in. Potentially, maybe not, but I reckon nine times out of ten, I'm right.
Yeah,
is check of this car. I know what kind of life you're leading.
I mean, I have seen people's cars, hamburger boxes and McDonald's wrappers,
and it's always like, cups. I'll take it out later.
A sock and
yes,
it's really gross. Uh-huh. Your car is an extension of yourself. You know?
Yeah.
Mm. You want people, that's why you have a nice car.
Yeah. And I suppose there's an excuse for the outside. I mean, it could rain and then you drive on a dirty road and, you know, you get dust all over your vehicle.
Yeah, my car looks like that today. It looks like it's, you know, driven through a 4x4 track.
Was that just because of the weather on the weekend?
No, I had to go somewhere before I came. Yeah. Okay. So, and it included a dirt road and it just rained last night. So it was muddy. Puddles everywhere.
Muddy, mushy.
It's looking like a proper Land Rover now.
It's looking like a proper Land Rover now. But that's the outside. What I try and do is every day or every other day, I take everything out of the car.
Yeah.
You know, try and think about the car as if, well, if I need to go and drop it off at the dealership or the airport or something now.
Yes. What is that guy going
to
think?
Do I need to take an entire crate of shit out of this car?
Correct.
You know.
Yeah. I don't tend to keep anything in my car besides the odds and sods in the cubbyhole.
Well, if you look in the center armrest of my car, you're going to find petrol slips going back to about 2016 because I don't throw those things away. I keep them. But that's about the only trash in the car. I'm particularly, you know, it's cloth on the dashboard to get rid of the dust.
Yeah.
You clean the inside of the windows when you vacuum on a regular basis. I mean, I have two kids as well, so it's like, they were forever trapping sand and mud and bits of grass and leaving school shoes and
but that's clean dirt, huh? That's all clean dirt.
I don't know how many CPUs dirty sock has.
I'll bring one next week.
My youngest daughter has a habit of that. You pick her up at school and first thing that comes off is the school shoes and the socks.
In the car.
One sock always gets left in the car.
Yeah, there's always that one sock that's moping around by itself. Yeah. Anyway, let's get on to our vehicle review for the morning. And we're chatting about is it the MUX? Is it the MUX? I mean,
industry accepted MUX.
MUX. And that's written with a small M, small U, and then a...
Why, I don't know.
I have no idea either. Yeah. But this actually looks like a fantastic, fantastic vehicle.
It is.
It really,
absolutely
does.
So, long story short,
yes.
Chev pulls out of the country.
Correct.
They take Trailblazer with them.
Yes.
Isuzu goes,
there's a gap in the market.
We'll keep that tooling, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just going to tweak it here and there. So what you end up with is Isuzu MUX. Looks like a Trailblazer. Drives like a Trailblazer, but it's not a Trailblazer. And it is an absolutely cracking vehicle. Now, I drove this thing for...
Yeah, you're right. The Trailblazer look is there.
It is. If you look at the quarter windows at the back, if you look at the hatch, the silhouette of the car, it looks Trailblazer. But if you put a Trailblazer and this thing together, you can see that they're different vehicles.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's like, okay, we used the tooling. We used the chassis and we've used some of the panels and changed this in there and we've probably got the same engine in it.
Yeah.
But... drove it to and from the office a few times. Of course, I had the diesel.
Okay.
So, 1,100 Ks on a tank.
Jeez luck.
And
how big is it? Is it? What is that, 65, 70 liters?
Yeah, I think it's about a 60 or 58, somewhere thereabouts. So, the big thing was the trip that I did with the car.
Yes.
So, we left home. We drove out to Rustenburg.
Okay.
Came over that little mountain range. That separates us from the northwest, all the way down to Hartie's, back down to Malibu and we went back to the East Rand. And I think I used a quarter tank of fuel.
Yes.
And we did some pretty hardcore off-roading. Right. The video that I did on this doesn't even do justice to that road that we're on.
Okay.
Now, it is one of the roads that we use to test a lot of our 4x4 vehicles because it is the type of road where you need 4-low.
Yes.
You're not getting over there without it.
Okay.
And, yeah, it feels luxurious, but it's not. It feels like you're driving a KB350. Well, now the Isuzu D-Max.
Yes.
Because that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
All the same touch surfaces that were in the D-Max. So you've got leather door cards, leather door handles, leather steering wheel, leather dash. It has a nice 6.3-inch infotainment screen, touchscreen with Apple CarPlay. All the seats are leather. It has multi-zone climate control, enough USB ports to keep the kids happy for days. And, of course, it's a 7-seater, so it has 3 rows.
Okay. And just quickly on that, the seats at the back, do they fold down sideways like a Fortuna, or they
drop into the floor?
Okay.
And that is probably one of the few things that I could complain about.
Yes.
When they're down, you have like 1,000 liters of space.
Okay.
It is, you can pack 4 dogs and 2 tents and a canoe, and it's plenty of space. But you put that third row of seats up.
Yeah.
There's no boot.
Okay.
You can barely get a camera tripod in there.
Okay.
So
that's obviously very, very,
very, very, very far.
Right back to the tailgate.
But super easy to raise and lower. They've got little pull handles.
Okay.
But it's the strap on the back of the seat is actually the lock.
Okay.
So you pull on the strap and it unlocks it and pulls it up. And then when you want to drop it, you just pull it down and push.
Okay.
As far as capability goes, absolutely amazing vehicle. It is, like I said, it's that hardcore agricultural rough and tough that you're going to get from like an Isuzu, but yet it's refined on the inside, so it has all the nice things that you would expect that to find in a Hilux or a Ranger. So other than that, you know, at $629,000, it's a bargain, and that's the top spec model. There's a lower spec model that comes in at $528,000.
Okay,
but it doesn't have the 4-wheel drive.
You know, I think if you're buying a vehicle like this, do you want it to have 4x4? I mean, or
it's a lifestyle vehicle.
Okay. So you're still going to tackle an off-road fine without 4x4, but if you're going to do some serious off-roading, then you need to have it
for this. Yeah.
So would this handle, like if you're going to Ponta in Mozambique, without 4x4, it'll handle those sandy roads? Or
no. With the weight of the vehicle, because I mean, it's almost 3 tons.
Okay.
I wouldn't try it.
I think there's very few 4x2s that will make that trip.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that trip in a RAV4.
Okay.
And that sand is super soft.
It is proper.
You can deflate to 0.8 bar. You need 4-wheel drive or at least some form of all-wheel drive to get through there.
I went there in a Fortuna and deflated the tires, and I passed some X5s.
Up to the belly
pan. Yeah. Bottomed out. I hope
you drove past
road.
Them.
I did.
Good.
And laughed.
I did. No, I mean, I would have stopped, but there were people helping them already. You know, because at least the least you could do is tow them out of their problem.
Yes.
But there was already people helping them. But I drove past X5s, and then you know what? The dumbest thing I saw. Somebody trying to make that trip in a Forester.
Four-wheel drive might, if you're very knowledgeable and you know what you're doing, you could be able to do it.
It's a car.
It's the all-wheel drive. And
yeah,
a Subaru.
But it's a car.
I mean, have seen guys do amazing things with Foresters, but that sandy road
is
not something you do with anything other than a...
I mean, there were a couple of occasions where that Fortuna was constantly spinning, and I thought, don't lose momentum, lose momentum. So 4x2, I don't know.
No.
I don't think so.
I did it in a Land Rover Freelander once.
Lucky you.
4x4?
No. 4x2, I think it was. But we got stuck like 12 times. But, you know, nothing a shovel
so
can't dig yourself out of.
The MUX.
Yes.
Like I said, 3-litre turbo diesel. 130 kilowatts, 380 newtons. So plenty of power underfoot. Doesn't feel laggy. Had plenty of get up. It wasn't going to get anywhere in a hurry.
Yes.
But it was going to get there with plenty of force.
And a comfy ride?
Absolutely.
You know, so if you wife and
you don't
kids and the
that,
dog, you're fine.
You don't feel that bounce that you would normally get with these ladder frame SUVs.
Okay.
But still, absolutely amazing vehicle, and I couldn't recommend it more.
Okay, and I see it also comes with a 5-year, 120,000-k warranty.
Yeah.
Which is also very good.
Yeah, so it's there was nothing said about service plans.
Yep.
But, I mean, it's an Isuzu, so you know the thing is like rock solid. It's not going to leave you standing high and dry anyway.
Yeah, CNA in an article said that the engine's bomb-proof.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so it's pretty good. It's the same engine, it's the top-of-the-line engine that you're going to find in the D-Max.
Yeah.
It really is. It's a cracking car. And if, like I said, if you don't like the Fortuner styling,
yes,
and you are afraid of customer reliability from a Ford,
yep,
this is the way to go.
Okay, fantastic. Lekker, yeah. Lawrence. Well, thank you very much. And there is an article on site, and you've got a video up there as well, right?
Got the video on site and the article.
Fantastic. So go and check that out. Auto Trader News and Reviews, and you can get all the information you need about that vehicle there. Right, gents, before we wrap up, let's get on to some electric car stuff. And I see that South African electric car sales are projected to grow significantly. George, and this is something that you also touched on Friday. What's the lie of the land looking like?
Well, I mean, the thing is, one thing we must remember, and most countries in the world, except for the guys that actually manufacture these cars, we're just assembly plants.
Yes.
We're not a manufacturer. We're an assembly port, if you want to call it, which is great, and you need those. So what does that mean? That means that we are beholden to whatever the actual manufacturer and the country of origin
sends out.
Yeah. That's it.
So it's like getting Lego for a child.
Yes.
Whatever's in the box, you build it, and that's the way
that's
it is.
That's it. Exactly. Happy days. Happy days. You're as an assembly dude if you're if you've got Lego and that's in a box.
That's
you
right.
Didn't actually conceptualize this
yes.
thing.
Yeah.
So that means, you know, South Africa has to follow what the rest of the world's doing.
Yeah.
And at the moment, the rest of the world is sitting at around 10 or 11% in electric cars. So South Africa has to get there. At some point, it has to get there. And, you know, I'm excited for the I-Pace,
yes.
which is coming out, I think, second quarter of this year.
Correct.
And it shows where the future is going. And we've already got the Leaf. You know, the new model looks a lot better than the old one. And, you know, I think I'm currently probably driving my last petrol-engined car.
Yeah.
Next one might just be an I-Pace.
Is that something? Is that where you would go? Is that? I mean, are you tending to? I mean, I know you're an advocate for
electric.
So you know.
Most companies in the world have got a strategy to 2025, which includes all electric.
Yes.
And the phasing out of petrol-engined cars. So we mustn't kid ourselves that South Africa is a different, you know, continent, we can't.
I mean, same as the iPhone, and you know, all the technology that we use in phones, exactly the same thing.
Exactly
our cars are going to follow suit.
Has to follow suit. We might just lag.
Yes,
but our cars will follow suit. So the projections are that we will reach around about 11% in 2025.
Of all new car sales will be electric.
Yes.
So it's seen here, so that the electric vehicle car park of 145,000 cars with annual sales of new electric vehicles of 43,000 units within the next 6 years.
I think that's low. I mean, look at what happened with the internet. You know, we were north of 5 years behind UK and America some, you know, 10 years ago. And that gap closed very, very quickly. Why did it close? Because we adopted smartphones at a fast pace, a really, really fast pace.
Yeah.
And we used 3G and 4G networks very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Fiber to the home was slow.
Yes.
But
the uptake of that now will
it just outpaces what the rest of the world did.
Yeah.
So I, you know, my gut feeling is that these projections are conservative.
So what you're saying, I mean, essentially is that we're not early adopters, but when the technology and everything starts to happen, everybody then jumps on the bandwagon.
Jump on the
because,
bandwagon.
You know, we know how South Africans are. About keeping up with the Joneses,
look at what's
right?
happening exactly. in the rest of the world. All the auto manufacturers, and I do mean all of them, from China to India to America, they're all focusing on electric technologies.
Mm.
And they've all pretty much come out and said, by X year, there will be no more. I mean, as it is, there are certain manufacturers that as of next year, no more diesels.
Sure.
No more diesels.
Mm.
So, yes, we will have to follow suit. And the technology does come from overseas. We do get the stuff that gets released overseas.
Mm.
You know, there are very few auto manufacturers that release a car elsewhere in the world that we don't get.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, we're up to speed with most of these cars.
I mean, we get most of what's available in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Barring a few brands that fall under umbrellas of companies that are already here that don't want to damage their market share.
Yeah. So I see not only about, you know, the electric vehicle sales, but I see in partnership with the electric vehicle charging authority, Gridcars, 30 million has been invested into 82 public electric vehicle charging stations on South Africa's major routes to lay the foundation for the future of electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles.
Somebody
in the country.
Had to do it.
Obviously, somebody had to do it. I haven't seen them on my, you know, on your daily commute or
but
in and around.
We will eventually reach a point where if you stop at a petrol garage,
yes,
there will be, like it is now, two diesel pumps on one side and six petrol pumps.
Charge. Yeah.
Now you're going to end up with two petrol pumps, one diesel pump, and a whole bunch of charging stations with parking areas in front of them.
Well, you know, one of the biggest barriers to the adoption is the price.
Yes.
And what hinders the price in South Africa is because these cars have to be fully imported.
Yeah.
It's not assembled yet.
It's a massive.
And the massive import duty.
Yeah.
So as soon as the government comes to the party and realizes that, hold on a second, for sustainable energy and the future of, you know, lowering the carbon footprint and all those things, we need to reduce the import tax on electric cars.
Yes.
And then potentially the adoption rate will climb.
And if you buy an electric car, you get kickbacks,
yes,
environmental kickbacks,
or money, absolutely. Because at the end of the day, I mean,
tax rebates,
okay. Yeah, cool.
So I think there's a long way to go, but once it starts, like you say, then I think it's going to
everyone's going to jump on. I see Nissan out in the Nissan globally have launched a education series because a lot of the people are still hesitant and don't really understand. You know, obviously we're in the industry, so we talk about it quite a bit. But I think Joe Soap on the road really doesn't understand too much about electric vehicles. And I see Nissan launched a YouTube series it's a four-part video series that covers charging, range, driving, and ownership, and thereby tackling the most common questions surrounding electric vehicles.
Is it animated?
Around it. No, it's not. It's actually they've got so leading the discussion is Tim Jarvis, and he's an Australian explorer and environmental scientist, and then Naya how do you say this?
Don't try.
Irish Adam, the founder of sustainable food business Broccoli Revolution in Bangkok, and they team up these two people and they take people through this series, and they just go through the nuts and bolts of owning, driving, and charging an electric car. And then I see one last thing, George, and you can tell us about this. Avoiding a speeding ticket is about to get a whole lot easier. Is it Google that's come up with it? I suppose.
Ford have they're introducing this technology which is based on the car's throttle. So obviously you'd probably be able to switch it on and off. No matter how much you depress that throttle, it will read the road signs, decide the speed limit read the speed limit, and then the car won't travel any faster than that speed limit no matter how you drive.
So it's like a governor.
Like a governor.
Governor on a golf cart. Those things.
I relish the day that autonomous driving relegates speeding to the annals of history.
Well, I think we would solve a lot of
the
problems in the traffic.
Officers will have nothing left to do.
Besides manage oaks that sit in intersections when you know the light's going to change and you still proceed to sit behind three cars that are already sitting in there and you block everybody for the left.
Bugbear, huh?
Yes. Yeah. it happened to me this morning and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly why I've got a pain in the neck. But anyway, guys, thanks very much. Yeah.
And then Google, just finally, yes. Google is rolling out an addition to their maps, which Waze has already got, which is the speed limits.
So they show you how fast you're driving.
What the speed limit is on that road.
Okay.
Time to update my app.
Yep, you better do that. All right, guys, well, have a fantastic week. And like we said, jump onto AutoTrader, your trusted motoring marketplace, news and reviews, all the information you ever need about the motor industry and cars and how-tos is there. Have a good week, everybody.
This is CliffCentral.com.